Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens, parents, families, educators, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that shape, challenge, and sometimes disrupt our daily lives. 411 Teen, where conversations matter. This week on 411 Teen, youth homelessness is rising at a startling rate, up 33% for children under 18 in just 1 year. Nearly 800,000 young adults are affected annually. Many are unaccompanied, coming out of foster care or unstable homes with no support and no place to go. Jennifer Stolo, CEO and producer of Robert Craig Films, talks about their powerful new film, No Address. She joins us on 411 Teen via the Zoom platform from Sacramento, California. Jennifer, welcome to 411 Teen.
Thank you, Liz. Happy to be here.
Glad to have you. What does homelessness look like today for young folks as compared to a decade ago?
Yeah, you know, our project, Liz, No Address, you know, started as a film that we really wanted to help depict the homeless situation in a more humanistic way. And we actually traveled across the United States to 18 major cities and 20 states to really study this crisis. And from that became a documentary as well, Americans with No Address. And it was just, I think the numbers were startling as we began to see 2.4 million people across the U.S. that were homeless, and more than half of them were children. As you said, in the last year, there's been a rise of 33% as we see our teens, those that are under the age of 18, and just so many affected. You know, I think what your question is how it looks differently as it relates to teen homelessness is usually hidden. It's not always necessarily your street homelessness. And so I think when, you know, when we picture people that are homeless and we look at the teens, the picture of a child under a bridge is not necessarily what we see. It is a lot of these teens doubling up, couch surfing or in motels that are still homeless and unstable. And so it looks so much differently, I think, than, you know, what we saw, like you said, a decade ago. And so much of it, you know, starts in the home with family conflict, abuse, neglect, you know, caregiver instability. The lead role in our film, No Address, is a foster care student. And as they leave the foster care system, they find themselves homeless. And this is a very true, realistic theme that we see across the United States. I know here in California, one out of every three that leave the foster care system end up homeless. Yeah. So it's a very different view out there, unfortunately, today, Liz.
What does a typical day look like for an unhoused teenager or young adult? I mean, and I'm talking about just basics. Finding food, you know, a place to shower, transportation. What are we looking at?
Yeah, there's two different ways I think that we've came across, especially as we look at our documentary, Americans with No Address, is that we found one of two things. We found teens or youth in shelter systems where they were there, you know, unaccompanied with their families primarily, but had come off the streets for shelter, particularly in areas where it was just bitter cold. And so they're in these shelter systems. Other situations that we see are the couch surfing. That is the most common that we can't actually measure, right? When they take the point in time count, you know, those numbers that we even said just now are much more. You know, we see, they say 38,000 on any given night is a youth out there, but really because of the couch surfing situation, there's so much more. You know, as a youth leaves, you know, the morning and heads out to find food, you know, oftentimes they go to food banks, they beg on corners, they create unconventional type families, you know, on the streets. We saw that tremendously happening and how in a good way they can support each other, but they create these type of, you know, families, so to speak, on the streets. But, you know, it's unsafe. It's dangerous. I always say it's easier to get high on the streets than it is to get help. And so often there are so many different gateways that a youth finds themselves in this situation, mental health, many of the crises that I just explained as far as being within the family. And then when they find themselves out there, then their drugs are there. And then it becomes a whole different type of situation because of the mental health and the drugs and everything that becomes available to them on the streets. And it's a very sad situation. It's just heartbreaking to see, young people of our country in this situation.
Well, we've talked about, you mentioned, how so many of them, exit the foster care system. They age out of the foster care system. But does this, what about the moral responsibility of the child care or child welfare system? Do they not have any responsibility in this as far as where you sit?
Well, I say everybody has a responsibility, right? I mean, we are a community, we are a society. When we think about our most vulnerable, I say our children and our elders are the most vulnerable. And when we see a rise in those two audiences, so to speak, on our streets, it's just very saddening. And we need a front door that teens can actually use. They need safe places. They need trusted adults. They need low barrier access, these low barrier shelter systems that allow them to come in, come as you are. We believe that, meet people where they are, not where we think they should be. And that reduces that judgment of how we see this. The services that require a teen to prove that they're in crisis, are often a difficult, a difficult place. And so that short-term stabilization, self-shelters, hosting homes, crisis beds, rapid pathways to housing, these type of support systems are critical. And so often we see many schools do a good job with that and others that don't. And school is, it is the number one place where this can be prevented, rather than a reactive situation.
Well, what about this? This chronic instability. How does this chronic instability shape the young person's development, their mental health, and their identity formation?
Absolutely. I mean, we know how critical stages of young life are, just, birth to five and how the brain, develops at that point in time. Well, teens, it's the same situation, they're going through so much just as a regular teen. And so then to be in these unstable situations or fragile households, that it's just a tragedy to see that side of homelessness because it's visible in the schools. And so if we can focus there and create the systems that help a child with child welfare, community organizations before it becomes crisis, that's where we need to act early.
When it comes to shame, say, and stigma, do you feel that those positions of feeling shameful or have their stigma attached to it, do you feel that that prevents the youth from seeking help or disclosing that they are homeless?
Yes, I mean, 100%. That's so much about what our project is about. It's really showcasing the human side of homelessness. And our theme is that homelessness can happen to anyone. The storylines that we depict in the feature film, No Address, really showcase that. It's, the girl that's in foster care. We see that situation with teens. But we see the successful businessman with a couple of bad deals, some things happen. Everything starts to fall apart in his life. He starts to lose his home, therefore his children are affected. And when we talk about judgment and we just look at someone, I always wonder, what is the backstory to that story? Because there is one. And so often what we learn, they were the untold stories, that not the stories that you think they are. One small thing can happen in someone's life or in someone's family, and everything can flip upside down. There's a reason that almost 50% of those that are in the US are one paycheck away from being homeless. And that's how fragile life is. So if you are parents, therefore your children are in that same scenario. And so often, when I talked with individuals on the streets, youth, adults, elders, so often they would say, we feel invisible. We're here. Many of them are trying to get help, and there's so many barriers. Others are in situations where they need more outreach to be able to draw them into the programs that can help them. But it's all about dignity. Every human being deserves dignity. And I always see it as like homelessness isn't a separate issue from the rest of society. It's
No,
actually
it's
like a
part.
mirror. You know, and if we were willing to look honestly into it as a community, we can respond with compassion instead of fear. And I think that's so often what we came across in making this project, you know, that it's more about the people necessarily than it is about the problem, so to speak.
In your research and doing No Address, did you find any states or programs that are getting it right?
Absolutely. So if you watch our documentary, Americans with No Address, as I said, you know, we really set out on this journey to study homelessness for the purpose of ensuring that the feature film, No Address, would be authentic. And it was really out of that. And so as we journeyed across the country and we found what's not working, certainly, but what is working, and then how we got here as a country, that's what the documentary focuses on. And so as we left, I would be honest here, you know, I'm here in California, as we left more of the West Coast and we began to get into the Midwest and certainly East Coast and South, there were some incredible programs. In Texas, they do a wonderful job in San Antonio with Haven for Hope. It's a wonderful campus-like model. And that was one of the things that we saw were these campus-like models that had every type of resource that anyone needed on the campus, all of the wraparound services to be able to help them. Because every individual, I always say it's like if you had a heart condition, Liz, and I had a heart condition, we would both be treated completely differently, even though we're calling it a heart condition. It's the same with homelessness. Everybody has a different pathway that they need to get to. So when we saw these campus-like models, when we saw these community models that really provided everything, you know, there's always that argument back and forth. Is it housing? Is it treatment? Is it this?
Yes.
And, you know, what we saw, it's everything. You know, solutions require housing, they require mental health support, they require employment pathways and community involvement. You know, and those every small action matters. And so that's what we found, whether it was one specific place like Haven for Hope or many of the other nonprofits that we saw on the front lines of this, it was really a culmination of wrapping every service possible around the individual. And that's what helped them to move forward.
Well, we know that many young people leave home due to abuse or rejection or some kind of trauma. And what I'd like to have us explore and have you share, because I'm sure you know firsthand, when talking to these youth about how trauma may compound the young youth, their problems, how trauma impacts them. So we're going to take a brief break, okay? And we'll get back and talk about the trauma. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. This edition is looking at youth homelessness. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you. Just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and I am talking with Jennifer Stolo. She's a CEO, and she was involved directly with No Address, the film that is soon to come out, if it's not already out, about youth homelessness. Jennifer, before we went on break, I was asking you just about the impact of trauma. And what you have found to be its contributing factor as far as homeless is concerned among young people.
Yes, Liz. You know, as far as the movie No Address, as you just mentioned, yes, it is streaming, so it is available to everyone, as well as Americans with No Address, the documentary. It is streaming everywhere too.
Okay, well, you
And
want to share, you can you share where, now that we're talking about exactly where folks can access it? Do you have that?
yes. So if you go to noaddressmovie.com, it lists
Okay.
everywhere it's streaming, including Amazon, Apple TV, YouTube, and others.
Okay. All right. Now, what about the impact of trauma? What are you finding? What did you find in with these young folks as far as
Yes, but
abuse and rejection and just trauma?
absolutely, Liz. You know how trauma can affect homelessness and youth. It's just incredible. Trauma often comes before homelessness. And I think that's the important thing that we have to see, that Most homeless youth in the US are not traumatized because they're homeless. They're homeless because of trauma, right? So when we think about trauma, 70 and 90% of the homeless youth, they report at least, they call them ACE, an adverse childhood experience, which is like abuse, neglect, family violence, parental substance, use. And those were the stories we began to see. Just so many multiple reports of this is what would lead to this. For many young people, homelessness isn't the first trauma. It's really the aftermath. And then, to that point, Liz, then once they're homeless, youth face that ongoing
Oh, God.
exposure to danger, right? That compounds that early trauma, and so often then you find then those reports of victims of assault, theft, sexual abuse, sexual violence, out on the streets. And it, homelessness doesn't really pause for trauma, right? It
Yeah,
deepens it.
it
So it's
makes it
just
worse.
layer after layer.
Well, and we also have to talk about the interruption of academic progress, because a homeless student may attend three, four, even five schools in a single year. And how does this academic turbulence affect future success?
Right. Because trauma, it disrupts brain development, right, during these critical years. And like we said, 0 to 5 is one set of critical years, 6 to 18 is, so there's so much of how trauma can really disrupt the brain development that obviously makes them unsuccessful, as they move through school. And then layer that with depression and the anxiety, that begins to happen. And then we get down that road to suicidal, attempts. So it's one thing after another. And then as we begin to look at education, then it interferes with learning, and then it interferes with trust in adults. And that's where a child needs to have trust is at school with their teachers. It affects their peer relationships, which teens certainly need their peer relationships. And then all of this causes that long-term, instability, just trauma driving, risky coping behaviors, right? So then it leads to the next piece of it, that we get higher rates of substance use, different involvement, in other, unhealthy habits, so to speak. And so, it's so important that I think people understand that there's, trauma-informed care that really can help, children move through this, their stable relationships. It's critical for housing, early intervention, so that we can, again, it's all about prevention, right? How do we set a student up for success when they have all of these barriers that are living in front of them, and they need to be at school learning, and being with their peers and being kids?
Well, what do teachers and counselors, from your perspective, based on your research, what do the teachers and counselors need to understand about students who are unstably housed? Because I think there is definitely a breakdown there.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, it goes back to a little bit of what I was saying, how we so quickly judge situations, right? So not to say that teachers or counselors are doing that, but it's just a natural human place for, I think, all of us, because we've become so conditioned to walk down the streets and see this in every part of the country, some more than others. And so it's almost given us this numbness that, we walk by an individual and we put our head down, we look at our phone, we turn away, we have thoughts of disgust. And that's no different for a teen. That's no different for the way our peers, judge our teens. It's no different than possibly, adults within our systems that can do that too. And so it's really important that, we find ways to lead with safety and trust. And, how do you put that important adult in a teen's life? How do you as a teacher, you as a counselor, be for that child of what matters the most? Because a traumatized student, is feeling unsafe. And then from that, they can no longer learn. They withdraw, they become irritable, there's anger, and then therefore there's missing assignments and absences. And how do we again meet someone where they are, not where we think they should be? Liz, we have this amazing program up here at our junior college, Sierra College here in my local area, and they've done a great job with creating outreach programs as they found, surprisingly, that so many students were sleeping in their cars in the parking lot while they were going to school. And it was just a great program they put together. They started building some affordable housing dorms for these students. And I think, again, back to your point, teachers and counselors and those individuals in schools and universities and colleges need to identify that. Who's living in their cars? Who's couch surfing? You know, who's staying in motels? Who's doubling up with other family or friends? Create that trust so that a student can confide in you so that you can find the right resources for them.
Well, we know that not finishing school is one of the biggest risk factors for adult homelessness, okay? So, you know, they are between the rock and the hard place if you're a youth and unhoused. You know, there's a high risk between dropping out and then youth homelessness and then not having, you know, a high school diploma. That's a strong predictor of adult homelessness.
Absolutely. Right. Yeah. When education is, you know, interrupted, all things can happen, right? Early in life, later in life, you know, then becomes all kinds of instability issues. And that's where so often, you know, foster care begins to happen. And to your point, you know, without education, you know, it's hard to get a job. You know, it's hard to care for other people. It creates all kinds of instability as you move into adulthood. You know, it's interesting, Liz, as you talk about, you know, adulthood and even just seeing the rising of different ages, you know, as we begin to see, you know, here in California, we saw that 50% of those on the streets became homeless after the age of 50. And many of them, or much of the work has talked a lot about, you know, having a job for, say, 40 years, 30 years, and then being laid off, you know, or situations during COVID, and then not having the proper, you know, degree that was needed to get back into the workforce. And so these kinds of numbers are rising, whether it starts with a teen dropping out of high school, or we see it, you know, later down the road in life. But definitely, you know, when you interrupt education, you interrupt a child's life completely and their future.
Youth of color and let me get it right, LGBTQIA2S plus youth are vastly overrepresented in the homeless youth populations. Would you address some of the structural forces? And I'm talking about things like racism and discrimination and family rejection that you have encountered that may drive these disparities.
Yeah, you know, I mean, so much of I think what we see is, you know, potentially, and again, I'm just, you know, from my observation and things that we've talked to people about, but certainly economic and housing inequities. You know, we see that, you know, back to your education, you know, education and school resource gaps. You know, that very much, you know, in different communities. A great deal of the foster care system. You know, many Black children grow up with one parent, and so there's many times that scenario seems to be a higher percentage for whatever reason in foster care. You know, and just, you know, compounded barriers. Once individuals become homeless, you know, back to your LGBT community, you know, as far as just judgment all around, you know, I mean, it just in general, right? There's just our whole society judges people for who they are. And if we looked beyond, you know, everything that we're talking about here, and we just look deeply into the human being, you know, it's really all about seeing each other as just human beings. If we see people differently, we respond differently, you know, and so it creates all these inequities and you know, finds ourselves and some particular groups, you know, with more, you know, more staggering numbers unfairly, you know. And it's difficult. It's difficult to see that because it shouldn't be that way for anyone. No matter the situation, we should all have systems in place in all of our states and all of our communities where wraparound services are available to every person, of every color, every ethnic group, every situation, so that everybody has an equal opportunity to succeed in life.
How do housing, and we talked mental health services and education systems, how do they intersect?
Well, I would say, you look at the past, it's almost 4 decades that our documentary takes you through as far as Americans with no address and how we got here as a country. And I think it's important because a lot of times people think, this all happened in the last, 10, 20 years, or this, was
No.
increased dramatically through COVID. And, it really is it's a long process of kind of where we got here as a country, both, on a federal level, on a state level, on a local level. And, I think, as
And
we
excuse me
begin.
for adding this, we are just starting to pay attention to it. I
Yes,
mean,
we are.
really paying attention to it. You might hear a little bit about it here and there, but I mean, we're just, and I think that's also important and it needs to be noted.
Exactly, Liz. I completely agree with you. And how sad it is that we're now finally looking at it, right? That it had to become this level of millions and millions of people that are out there, particularly back to our point here as teens. Our children are out on the streets, they're couch surfing, So as we look at it, we found that as I go back to that, it was really a comprehensive approach. It's complex, for it, no doubt, it's complex. But it's not all housing and it's not all mental health treatment, right? It's a combination. We found in the most successful programs that the combination of all things was what worked. We partnered with 1,500 nonprofits nationwide to really see, on the front lines what they were doing. And it was those programs that really blend everything together, that put it all together in one place and provided all the services, that an individual that would need or a family needs.
What have you observed about communities? Now, and I know they vary. Some of them are better at what they do than others. But how can communities as a whole become safer and more inclusive for vulnerable young people?
I would say the number one issue that's the barrier to that, Liz, is what we call NIMBY. It's the not in my backyard. And that is one of the largest barriers that I see as, as we work with these nonprofits across the United States and organizations that are trying to put together programs that are necessary in their communities. And, many communities are wonderful about that, and they really collaborate with their elected officials and their nonprofits and their community leaders. And other communities are not so great at that. There's very much of a, I think so often once homelessness, used to be such a, it used to be in our cities. It wasn't in our suburbs. It wasn't in our rural areas. And now it's everywhere, right? So, in the suburban, area, it's like, well, wait, we don't need a shelter here. We don't need programs here. Well, we do, because one, there's homelessness in every single community. And we learned that it is the number two, if not number one, problem in every single community across the United States. So whether that be a small little town in Arkansas that only has 10, because they're this small, well, they have a situation. And so the attitude of like, not in my backyard, I don't want it near me, it is something that saddens me. I spoke in Chicago on a national level about a wonderful program that are called medical respite programs. And I really feel strongly about how incredibly these programs are. And what they are, Liz, is that they are individuals who are in the hospital who have major conditions, heart conditions, cancer. They are critically ill in one way or the other. And when they are discharged, they are not well enough to be on the streets. But they're well enough to like not be in the hospital, right? So these medical respite programs that are a nationally acclaimed type of program, they have a referral system from the hospitals, and the hospitals refer them to these fabulous nonprofit organizations serving our homeless in our communities. And so when I've talked to so many nonprofits and they say, gosh, there's this resistance in our community, you know, to have a program of any type, I'm always dumbfounded with that one, because why in the world, if someone has nowhere to go after they've been discharged from the hospital and they still need medical care and, you know, not get an infection being on the streets, why wouldn't we have these programs that could help them get well or could help them move into hospice, because many of them do that, and or at the same time, while they're recovering, can get them into housing. And it's interesting to me, because I always find that one program, when someone says not in my backyard, I always kind of think, shame on that community, because that is something that would help so many individuals get well and actually help move them into housing. But it's that NIMBYism, you know, it's the not in my backyard. And I think if more communities can get past that and work collaboratively with all of their leaders, with their nonprofits, because that's who we identified that we're on the forefront doing the great work, like a Salvation Army, CityGate Networks, all of the organizations that we see locally here, the collaboration of elected officials and leaders can help move the needle.
And that leads right into my next question, and I talk about the elected officials. Because I know in working directly with some of the individuals who address those issues, we'll often talk about you need money. You really do need money. You can say we aren't doing this or we aren't meeting the needs, and they recognize that they are not meeting the needs. But they recognize to meet the needs, you really need the funds to provide the facilities and the support that these unhoused youth and adults both need, and they're not getting. And where do you go from there? And I don't know that you can answer that, but I know that's often the question that's raised and the response that I get. I ask you to just hold your thoughts for a minute. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. We're going to take a brief break.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? We tuned in to 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, and I'm talking with Jennifer Stolo, and we are talking about homelessness. Jennifer, what inspired Robert Craig Films to take on a project about homelessness?
You know, Liz, I think, you know, as we know, we all see it, right? It's right in front of our face all the time. And I think many of us as producers just had some personal experiences that really allowed us to lean in, you know, whether that be, you know, helping in our ministries at a church, whether that be volunteering in a shelter, whether that be one of our producers who actually had a lived experience. You know, we just felt so close personally to the topic. And it for us, we really wanted it to be about the human side of homelessness, about building empathy and compassion, rather than looking at it as a problem, but looking at it as with hope and a solution. And if we could build, you know, a film that was released nationwide last February, no address, that's streaming now, and have audiences all across the country see that and connect and possibly change the narrative, followed by Americans with No Address, which is a documentary that really showcases what's working, what's not working, and how we got here as a country, then we could do something about that. And as we did, it actually just became this viral movement, as they call it, the No Address movement. And a novel came from that, and an audiobook, and a soundtrack, and even an interactive study guide for the faith community. And for us, it just began to reach more audiences. And it's done, and it is doing what we hoped it would do, is to, you know, set it in motion for people to think differently, to walk down a street, look somebody in the eye, and say hello to them because they feel invisible. So we wanted to change the mindset and change the narrative. And in the end, we would hope, you know, that it changed the way people acted, that there was a call to action and they would do something locally in their community.
How did you, as a team, ensure authenticity?
So in order to ensure authenticity for the No Address movie, this is where we took this journey across the United States and really began to study homelessness. And because of the experiences and the interviews and the interactions that we had with elected officials and community leaders, the presidential administration, governors, those who are experiencing homelessness or had formerly done, we just had a wide breadth of individuals that we had conversations with that really helped us to make sure that we made these films, that there was authenticity, you know, that really told the true stories of what's happening to these individuals on the streets.
Were there any stories particular or real experiences that shaped the characters?
You know, I think each character really was, you know, an individual that we met on the streets. And interestingly enough, Liz, the movie was called something else. The screenplay by Julia Verdon was delivered to us with a different title. And, you know, as you know, the title is No Address. And one of the things that we found as we spoke to one individual in a homeless encampment is he explained to us all of the different things and the different obstacles and barriers he had because he had no physical address. And that opened our eyes from the very beginning of all the things we don't think of, right? We can't get our mail. We can't get our get a driver's license. We can't fill out an application for a job. You know, and those are the tangible things. Then when you think about if you don't have a key to turn and walk into a home, that means you don't have neighbors. That means you don't have a community. And there's so many different ways that he explained what it meant to not physically have an address. And that really shaped our mindset of what this all looked like. And so the five storylines, as we mentioned, foster care youth and a girl at the beginning of the story who graduates high school and goes back to her foster home. And the doors are locked because they're no longer receiving funds for her. And then you find the individual who's a successful businessman, a couple of bad things happen, and his whole life begins to fall apart and loses his home. Then you have our veterans that we see, you know, have come from war and, you know, have PTSD, addiction issues, depression. So we have storylines along that. And then a youth, a teen that many of what we're talking about here today that is in a violent situation in his home and the domestic violence forces him to flee from his home. And so the five of them band together as an unconventional family on the streets in the movie No Address. And it really begins to unravel, you know, the stories that we learned and saw consistently, you know, as we traveled the United States. These are all true stories, you know. They are, when I volunteer in the shelter here in my community, they were lawyers, doctors, baseball players. They're, like I always say, they're not the stories we think they are. And it's just one bad turn, one unfortunate situation, things can happen.
What about human dignity? What role does that play in all of this?
Yeah, I would say everything, right? Because shouldn't every human be, you know, should any human be denied dignity, you know? I think that's one of the biggest things when I say, you know, one of the stories I had as I approached an individual on the streets and wanted to, you know, engage and have a conversation because I know that helps them. And I walked up to this gentleman and I said, hello, sir, you know, what is your name? And he looked at me very blankly and I said, I'm so sorry, you know, I just was wanting to ask your name so, you know, I could have a conversation with you or think about you, you know, or say a small prayer for you. And he looked at me and he said, I am so sorry. It's my fault. I was so shocked by your question because I cannot remember the last time somebody asked me my name. And it was in that moment that I thought, wow, we can be better, right? We can be better. You know, I had another story. Because this always defines, I mean, it's a very upsetting story, but it defines how one thing in someone's life, you know, if we look at people and we judge them and we don't offer them the dignity that they deserve, it, you know, it's somewhat shameful because we don't know the story. And I was talking with this individual, a man who had been on the streets for a while, and the way his story went was a very successful businessman who had a son who was 18 and was leaving for college. And the two of them planned to get together for lunch a few days before he left for college. Dad was on one side of the street at the restaurant. The son was on the other side of the street. The son saw his dad, went to wave to him in excitement, like, and stepped off the curb and was hit by a car and killed in front of his father. And the father said, "My life just ended that day. Like, I just couldn't get up in the morning. I couldn't go to work. I couldn't do anything. And then I began to lose my marriage. And then I began to drink. And I just lost my life." And, you know, I think as a parent, I have six children, and I just can't even imagine the loss. I was the CEO of Make-A-Wish here in California, Nevada, for 10 years. And I've watched parents lose their children. And it is the most devastating thing ever. And life turns upside down for an individual, a parent in that scenario. And so it goes back to, we can't judge people by what we think we see, you know, on that cardboard sign, right? Because there is a person behind that that could have a story just like that. And it could happen to any of us.
What impact do you think storytelling has? Do you think that storytelling tends to open hearts in ways that statistics cannot?
Absolutely. 100%. I believe in nothing more than how storytelling humanizes what statistics cannot, right? Stories help us to see and to feel. Numbers are important, right? But they can make us feel distant or even overwhelming, right? When we talk about, you know, the 2.4 million, the 33% rise in teens, the 800,000 of them affected in our U.S. But a story introduces a name. It introduces a face, a moment, just like the story I just told you. You know, every time I tell it to someone, I know in their mind, they depict what this person must have looked like, how they felt as a parent. And I think once people can connect emotionally, the issue becomes real, right? Mm-hmm. So statistics really just tell us how big the problem is, but the stories tell us who it belongs to. And, you know, it challenges our stereotypes, right? In this project, we found it that it replaces judgment and understanding, and it really just invites listeners to relate rather than just, you know, rescue, right? It's a way, you know, to open space, I think, for reflection rather than reaction.
What kind of suggestions do you offer to community organizations and local leaders?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's
on homelessness, youth homelessness, and adult homelessness, because if they're homeless as youth and we don't get it together then, you know, the options become even less as they become adults.
Right, right. You know, I think, you know, so often, you know, our local officials, they set the tone, right? They set the tone for what this scenario looks like. They set the tone whether homelessness is addressed with urgency or avoidance. And and communities do it one way or the other. You know, whether homelessness is treated as an emergency or like a background issue, you know, how visible is it, how urgent the need is, you know, whether those solutions are coordinated or they're fragmented. You know, they play a critical role. And I think back to your point earlier, Liz, you know, about funding and resources, there's lots of different ways that communities can receive federal and state funds and how they're used locally, you know, whether the money supports prevention, you know, shelters, housing, mental health, outreach, you know, however it aligns with the community and what they actually need. But it's really not so much about how much money exists, it's about how wisely it is used, you know. And seeing that a lot, you know, and who are the players in all of that, right? So like I said, we partnered with 1,500 nonprofits across the United States. We believe they were at the forefront of that, you know? So if people can, they have the means to give to them, give to them. If you have the time to volunteer, it will make a profound difference on the individuals that are in those programs. But I assure you, it will make a profound experience on yourself, you know? And then as we talked about earlier, how critical schools are, right? They are the trusted adults so many times that these teens will lean into. And then you have your healthcare providers, you know, law enforcement. There's so many wonderful cities that we saw that had outreach programs within their law enforcement. I know we have one here in our community in Roseville. And, you know, and then your faith and your community organizations, You know, there's no single organization that can solve this alone.
Right.
It's leadership is about alignment. All of it has to be working together.
Well, you mentioned, you know, not only is it about the money, but it's how the money is spent. And I think that that was a real important point. And in addition to that, establishing priorities. I mean, homelessness has to be a priority. Do you have any suggestions? I mean, you've been out there. You've been out there on the streets of how we can establish priorities, how we can encourage the leaders that be to establish this as a priority. This is a real problem. Even though they see them and they walk around them and over them, how do you do that?
Yeah, you know, and I think, you know, sometimes leadership isn't about actually creating the programs. It's about removing the barriers, right? You know, we see so many barriers, you know, out there. And so, you know, how do, you know, the local officials can shape, you know, to your point, priorities, right? Zoning, you know, land use decisions,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
The availability of affordable housing. I'm just now seeing in my community, all of a sudden, affordable housing is just like going up everywhere. It's like, okay, where have you been the last 20 years, you know? The speed of permitting and approvals, you know, we see that all so much red tape here, you know, in California, and it just takes forever to get something done. So in places like Arkansas and Texas, where I saw the speed, you know, and willingness, you know, of those approvals. And then again, back to how welcoming, you know, or restrictive your communities are to the services, back to the NIMBY, you know, to it. So it's prioritizing, but then that collaboration and then balancing the compassion and the accountability, right? We need to protect public safety. I don't tell everybody to walk up to any individual on the streets, right?
Yeah.
It is about public safety. And there are lots of scenarios of situations that are not safe, right? But at the same time, we have to respect dignity and human rights, you know, and how do we support, you know, our residents and our businesses at the same time that we are putting the priority of those individuals on the streets, right? It's inhumane in so many places that I have walked by. You know, you walk down Skid Row in LA. Thank goodness the weather's warm. But if it wasn't, you know, it's just inhumane in so many places that you walk by. And it's just as a community, we just need to be better. You know, we need to hear from the experts. We need to include all voices at the table. We need to plan and collaborate together, design solutions, you know. You know, the best solutions are shaped by the people closest to the problem. So who are we talking to?
Well, in these last 3 minutes, I have two quick questions I want to ask you. First, any suggestions as to how teens can support their peers who are unstably housed? Do you have any?
Yeah, you know, I think it's listening closely to your friends, right? So many times I hear students say, you know, I just didn't realize, you know. There's a phenomenal nonprofit here of a young girl that started her foundation at age 13. She's going to be 21. And in school, she realized that children did not have the basic hygiene essentials. Mm-hmm. And she started a program where she goes all around California and she goes to school districts and we build hygiene kits for schools. And I think I mean, this is an amazing program. Obviously, she does for the schools across California here. But as teens, you know, listen to our students, watch, help, be able to help them open up and talk about things. I'll never forget this, Liz, is that in my community, we went to help in a shelter and I brought my three teenage daughters at the time. We walked in and one of the boys that was in the shelter was someone in their very school. And it was this eye-opening moment where they came home and said, Mom, he's a football player, he's a straight-A student, and he lives in the shelter down the street. And I think if we all could realize like that is happening, you know, how do we as a community, how do we as schools, how do we as our fellow students and our peers be helping, you know, someone bring them into a counseling office and say, I recognize that something's going on here, you know? Not to tell on them, but to have these conversations. Kids, you know, are so close. They don't open up, especially boys don't open up at this age. And so we just have to watch carefully to know and see what's going on and help them. Every child needs help in this scenario.
Well, despite the scale of the crisis, in 30 seconds, can you give me What gives you hope? How do you keep on?
Oh, you know, people say
it's got to be 30 seconds.
Okay. People tell me all the time it's a hopeless situation. And I always say, no, it's hopeful. I have seen the solutions. I have seen the programs across the United States. I have seen the collaboration in communities with elected officials and leaders. It can happen. And there's plenty of funding at the federal level. Communities need to know how to pull that down and to utilize it in the right way in their community. It is not hopeful. It is hopeful. It is not hopeless.
Any additional resources you would refer very quickly outside?
NoAddressMovie.com has a directory that can direct you to nonprofits. It also can give you education as far as the documentary on what our American crisis is facing right now.
Okay, well, it's time out. Youth hopelessness is not inevitable and it is not invisible. Thanks to the work of Jennifer Stolo and Robert Craig Fims. No Address challenges us. To my listening audience, much appreciation for your time and your ear. Get the 411 on 411 Teen. The 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Holyfield. Technical assistance provided by Taylor Cox. If you would like to participate in 411 Team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. You can listen to previous episodes of 411 Team at wfsu.org.